We are back. Let's go. Welcome to Season 10, Episode 151 of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. Can you believe we made it? Welcome back. Last we talked, it was Christmas time, and I interviewed Dr. Jordan Frith about his excellent book, Barcode. Did you get that on the syllabus? What a treat that conversation was. This season, Season 10, I still can't believe it. Just, can we take a moment? 5 full years of the Big Rhetorical Podcast at the end of this season. And this season is going to be incredible. We have a lineup of scholars and authors. We continue our undergraduate internship program and hope to name an emerging scholar winner. We're going to be on location in Denver, Fort Worth, and maybe even a surprise location or two. Stay tuned. And we are trying to go back to where we started, which is amplifying the work of emerging scholars like Anuj Gupta. Okay, before we get to the interview, I want to share some news and notes. DRPC Privacy Week was a success in January. Make sure to visit drpcollective.com to learn more about the event. I have to send a special shout out to my collaborators on that project, Morgan Chin, Cecilia, Noah, and Gavin. I'm going to be at RSA and Computers and Writing Conference this year. Reach out if you want to grab a drink or meet up. I am presenting at the pre-conference events too at RSA, like the ASHR Symposium. Anyone want to work on their presentations together? Reach out to me. Let's see. There's a few interesting NTT jobs out there. Do you want to be the director of composition at Oregon? Perhaps you want to move to be a lecturer of composition at Louisville or Illinois. Make sure you check the deadlines for those. I'm pulling directly from the WPA listserv. There's also an interesting job at Kansas State University's College of Technology and Aviation, CODA. They're looking for an instructor of technical communication. Check that out if you're interested. Let's see. Okay, make sure to get your proposals in for the bad ideas about writing with AI CFP if you haven't already. Excellent lineup of editors there you might get to work with. And Michael Madsen's doing the Writing in the Health Professions Conference again this year. I think it's virtual, but double check. April 1st is the due date for submissions there. Georgia Kate, my daughter, is almost 8 months old. Can you believe that? I should have taken a step back last fall, but I didn't, and I wound up in the black hole. So I took some time away from podcasting. Actually, the longest non-summer break since TBR started, 3 full months. And I consolidated projects, did some writing, and reconfigured out how I approach this job, this career, this life as a father. As someone who I always felt like I had to put work first, you know, that was tough. That might sound wild to some of you. I know that, but I struggled with giving up work, reprioritizing work. But to me, I guess it feels pretty natural given what we've chosen to do with ourselves. Okay, enough of that, but two more notes. Hey, are writing programs and writing centers thinking about connecting with athletics? How are they doing that? I feel like we have the skills and curriculum as instructors and administrators, designed to teach athletes the critical digital literacies needed to capitalize on their NIL deals, right? A lot of that includes social media usage. So I'm sure a lot of programs have that internal to their athletics program. Someone's working with the athletes, and many schools probably have comp sections just for athletes, right? We know that. But are other smaller schools doing this as NIL expands? Who in our field is researching this? Is anyone doing this? Reach out. If not, I think this is an idea that I'm giving to you. Finally, I've been wanting to go to Writing Buddies for like the last 2 months. Hopefully, I find my way there this week?
So earlier as a literature student, I was very interested in existing literature, existing language, and how it had shaped reality. Then as I moved towards more composition and writing, I started to feel like how we can create new forms of text to change the reality that we are a part of. And now I guess what I'm starting to realize is that this creation of language is a very complex, layered, networked phenomena where it's not just humans who are doing the writing, but it's actually humans who are part of machine cyborgic networks, who are part of kind of layers of cultural, historical chaos and all kinds of things that mix into each other to produce everything.
Anuj Gupta is a doctoral candidate in the Rhetoric Composition Program in the Department of English at the University of Arizona. In the past, he has helped build one of India's first college-level writing programs at Ashoka University as a WPA. A winner of Kairos's Graduate Student Research Award, C's Scholars for the Dream Award, and the AACU's K. Patricia Cross's Future Leaders Award, Anuj's research has appeared in journals like Open Praxis, Composition Studies, and in edited collections like TextGen Ed. He is currently working on his doctoral dissertation, where he is studying the impact of generative AI chatbots on academic and technical communication by analyzing ChatGPT prompts as an emerging genre of writing. And oh boy, do we get into that. This is a must-hear interview, and I hope you enjoy my interview with Anuj Gupta. Who are you? What's your name, your institutional affiliation, your title, your role there? Who are you and what do you do?
You know, I've heard many of your podcasts, Charles, and this question kind of always stumps me. Like, you start off with this big existential question, but I think I'll keep it down to the basic facts. My name is Anuj Gupta. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, which is in the southwest part of the US. And I'm in the Rhetoric and Composition program there in the Department of English. I'm currently working on my dissertation, where I'm studying the impact of generative AI technologies like ChatGPT on academic, technical, and business writing. And apart from my dissertation research, I'm also a graduate assistant there in the Department of English and the Office of General Education. And as part of this role, I've done a whole range of projects over the last 4 years. I've taught English 101 and 102. I've taught technical writing classes. I've taught advanced user experience research methods classes. I also have experience with data science methods. So I help the Office of GenEd kind of analyze student enrollment data, course proposal data to kind of help in their decision making. I've done instructional design work to design kind of interactive books and do consultancies with teachers. And most recently, I was also a research assistant for a digital humanities lab at my university, where we designed a really cool augmented reality visualization exhibition inspired from the works of W.E.B. Du Bois at Harvard University. Yeah, that's me. That's who I am.
Incredible, right? Big question, big answer. You've got a lot going on, and your research is so interesting. I'm so glad that we're able to chat today. I do want to ask a little bit, what are you teaching this semester? What you mentioned you've taught in the writing program, tech comm courses. What are you teaching this semester?
So this semester, interestingly, I'm not teaching anything. I was teaching the user experience research methods class last semester in the fall. But this semester, my entire assistantship is with the Office of General Education, where I'm doing some of the data processing work that I spoke about.
One of the things that's interesting about that, Anuj, and I guess my question is very much like, I don't know. So like, what is the overlap that you're seeing in this working with data science in the Office of General Education versus some of the work you do in your own research in the field?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because it's so connected to teaching and to writing and to kind of, I like to use the metaphor of the stage. Like when you're a teacher in the classroom, it's kind of like you're performing on a stage and you have your audience, which is the students. But once you start doing some of this interconnected administrative work, which you often end up doing as a WPA or in other kinds of positions, you start to realize that the stage does not exist in isolation, but there's a huge network of things that kind of make the stage possible. And that's where I see the overlaps really with a lot of the stuff that's going on between my teaching, between my data analysis work with GenEd and my dissertation. Because of the back end, what's happening is that there are so many technologies that are processing the huge kind of numbers of students who come in, the different courses that they take, different teachers who submit courses to teach them. There's a whole pipeline about how courses get reviewed and processed. And there's an amazing bunch of administrative people who make that possible. So working closely with them really gives me an insight of like what goes on every day to make a teacher's performances on the stage happen.
That's so cool. Yeah. Like there's this whole network of people working to make us successful. Oh, great.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you've been in Tucson for a while now, a few years, like 3 or 4 years. But where did you grow up? Tell me more about your undergraduate experience and how that propelled you to be an educator. This might be roles and responsibilities, etc. I'll let you take it however you wish.
Yeah. So I grew up in Delhi, India. I lived there my whole life before coming to Arizona for my PhD. And at the undergrad level and at the master's level, I studied English literature in Delhi University and at a university called the Jawaharlal Nehru University. And India is pretty heavy on STEM and engineering. And I used to be very interested in physics and computer science as well as in literature. But unfortunately, I did not have any program that would allow me to take all those classes. So I took literature and I really enjoyed it. What I really fell in love with is cultural studies and the kind of cultural analysis that literature folks do. I used to be a big fan of, still am, a big fan of Roland Barthes and his essays. And the first time it kind of blew my mind that you could analyze something like, he has this beautiful collection of essays called Mythologies, where he analyzes things like toys. And he makes the argument that the kind of toys that we grew up playing with, they condition us into adopting gender roles that society expects us to adopt later on in lives. So boys will often end up playing with racing cars and fighter planes, and girls often with dolls or kitchen sets and things like that. And that was the first moment where I got this aha kind of insight about how culture, language, rhetoric, these kind of things really shape who we are as people and as societies. And that was the moment where I realized, like, okay, somewhere along this line is where I want to build my life, do this kind of analysis, do this kind of work. So I got really interested in literature and cultural studies at that time. And I think there are two defining moments which then gently kind of helped me pivot from literature to writing studies. I got an opportunity to teach a writing workshop at a school called the Tibetan Children's Village in Dharamshala, which is a state, a city in a state called Himachal Pradesh in India. Lots of mountains there. It's absolutely beautiful. So in this school, I went for a week and I was teaching writing, creative writing, in fact, to grade 3 and grade 4 students. And I created a short story writing module for them, but they came up with such beautiful stories, kind of processing their trauma. So these were students whose families were left behind in Tibet, and they had migrated to India, but their parents couldn't. So they were dealing with a lot of trauma, and some of the students wrote beautiful stories processing a lot of that. So for example, the student wrote a story about a character which was a butterfly, and the butterfly had been captured by hunters to kind of and it was being paraded around in different shows, and then the butterfly kind of makes alliances with other butterflies, and they fight the hunters and they break open their cages and they become free. And I saw how, like, maybe that's connected to a lot of things that the child experiences in her real life, and she's using writing as a way to process that. And that was another moment where I was like, okay, writing is something magical, where we don't just analyze existing texts, we can actually change them. We can actually change the conditionings that people have created for us and change our realities. So that really kind of shifted me towards writing studies. And at this time, I got an opportunity to teach writing full-time at a university called Ashoka University in India. So I don't know, Charles, how familiar you are with kind of writing pedagogy as it exists outside the US. So in the US, you all have like hundreds of years of histories of rhetoric and kind of writing pedagogy, which is absolutely amazing. In India, though, writing pedagogy in this sense of kind of academic writing classes are fairly recent at the college level. We have a rich history of English as a second language instruction, but composition in this sense of advanced argumentation for all students at college, it's still emerging. And several writing programs and writing centers have sprung up over the last two decades. So Ashoka University is one of the kind of pioneers in that area. And I got an opportunity to teach there, absolutely fell in love with all the teaching that I did. And I was promoted to become the program's writing program administrator there. I was really young at that time. I think I was 25 or 26. And I was a WPA for a program with 200 students, 10 teachers. And it was really, really formative, all those experiences, which prompted me to come to the US to do a PhD in RETCOM.
A few things. First of all, I love hearing you talk about teaching writing. love hearing you talk about that. I could listen to this all day.
That's the kind of thing.
Here's a kind of a big question, not one, I don't know exactly where I'm going with it, but I'm going to try. How do you think about your experience as an educator, your journey, okay? And what you're focusing on right now in your research, how do you think about that trajectory? How you got from, oh, Roland Barthes is saying we can look at this, to where you are right now?
That's an excellent question. I think everything boils down to this little phrase that I use in my classes. In fact, one of my courses was titled this, the idea that language shapes reality and reality shapes language. There's kind of a circular relation between them. And everything in my journey, I kind of feel like I keep coming back to this equation with new insights and with new dimensions to look at. So earlier as a literature student, I was very interested in existing literature, existing language, and how it had shaped reality. Then as I moved towards more composition and writing, I started to feel like how we can create new forms of text to change the reality that we are a part of. And now I guess what I'm starting to realize is that this creation of language is a very complex, layered, networked phenomena where it's not just humans who are doing the writing, but it's actually humans who are part of machine cyborgic networks, who are part of kind of layers of cultural, historical chaos and all kinds of things that mix into each other to produce everything. And it's the technological side of that kind of actor network that I'm very interested in now in my dissertation, hence the huge interest in artificial intelligence. And I guess this has been an interest, as I said, as a kind of school student, I was really interested in computer science and physics. I could never take that up at the undergrad level. So it feels like that interest is now coming back and mixing into my existing interests.
Thanks for a response to that question. It was kind of off the cuff, but I think hearing about folks' trajectory, how they get to where they're at, is essential for our field. So you mentioned your research, your dissertation project. Let's talk about it. Tell me about your specialization, your focus of your dissertation. A couple of questions to let you riff. How did this dissertation project come to be? You know, what's its genesis and what exigencies are driving the work? I guess, why is it important now? Tell us about the project and I'll let you just riff for a bit.
Thank you. So the project is tentatively titled right now, Learning to Talk to Generative AI Bots, a Corpus-Driven Mixed Method Study of Prompts and Prompt Engineering for Academic, Technical, and Business Communication. I know it's a mouthful, it's a working title, but how I got here is, I think from the very first year of my PhD, some of my advisors gave me really good advice that I should take as many methods classes as I can. And I should really experiment with especially those methods that I'm not used to. So I started taking classes in corpus research, in quantitative methods, in qualitative methods. I took classes in learning how to code in Python, some statistics, some data science, while also taking the required qualitative classes in kind of qualitative coding, interviewing, ethnography, case study research, those kinds of things. So while taking the classes on Python and data sciences, when I got really interested in machine learning, and this is a couple of years before the whole ChatGPT kind of boom started to happen. So I was very interested in artificial intelligence at that time itself. But this hadn't happened. At that time, I was very interested in research on emotions and academic writing anxiety. I still am. And I used to kind of do sentiment analysis and kind of, I was very interested in how people were taking huge, big data sets of texts and trying to see how we can figure out what kind of emotional activity is happening, like where's the pathos in a text. Apart from human reading, can we also have machines do some of that analysis? So that's when I got interested in this. And I think in May 2022, when GPT-2, there was, I think, a trial version of that, I just happened to chance upon it. And I asked GPT to like write me an essay about writing pedagogy in India. And I was like, there's no way that this chatbot will be able to write anything, because honestly, many people in the US who specialize in Redcom might also not be able to write something on this, because it's such a niche topic, which not many people specialize in. But surprisingly, it wrote a relatively decent answer, and it just blew my mind. I was like, okay, this is definitely going to change a lot of things. I need to focus on what's going on. So that was the genesis of this project. And kind of very briefly moving into the specifics of what I'm doing within this large world of generative AI, I think I'm very interested in this big question that I had read in some of the works of Charles Bazeman. And recently, there's a book that a scholar called Cruz, along with Chris Anson and a few others, have come out with about digital writing technologies in higher ed. And in the introduction, along with Charles Bazeman, they asked this question, like, in a world where there are these robots and automated machines, what really will be left for human writers to do, right? What is the role of a writing teacher? What is the role of a writer if robots are doing all kinds of writing? And I feel like in response to this question, I've seen this huge umbrella movement of something called critical AI literacy emerge, the various kinds of things that humans can do. And your own work, Charles, with the Digital Rhetoric Privacy Collective, I feel like kind of aligns beautifully with that. There's recent statements by the MLA and CCC on it. I really like Mahabali and Anna Mills' work on it. So a whole bunch of people are responding to that big question. And my specific intervention in that area is to focus on this new genre of writing that I see emerging around me called AI prompts, which is kind of a new form of human-computer interaction. Essentially, a ChatGPT prompt or an AI prompt is the unique instructions that people write to ChatGPT-like tools to get desired outputs. And I've seen immense creativity in how people are adapting these tools to their context, using these prompts. Like, I've seen examples of people are joking with it, people are tricking it, people are using it as a research method to kind of unearth these technologies' biases. So in many ways, like, people are exerting their human rhetorical agency over these tools through the genre of prompting, which is shaping the outputs that are coming out of these machines. So I feel like the genre is really important because it is helping us answer that big question about what is left for humans to do. I think we get to shape what happens with these kind of tools by learning how to prompt them ethically and effectively. And in my dissertation, what I'm really trying to do is provide a descriptive snapshot of the genre as it is emerging specifically within writing studies. Like there are many people who are publishing the prompts that they're using with ChatGPT in journals and books and databases. So I'm kind of collecting them, creating a corpus of them and analyzing them to give a descriptive profile of this emerging genre so that teachers can use it, teach it, and we understand like what the hell is going on a little better.
So the last part of your answer kind of answered the next question, but you mentioned you took these research methods class. You invested in learning research methods. Well, this is an audio podcast, but I've got both digital methods books right here, right? From Del Hierro and Van Kooten, right? This is something folks need to be, like, this is on the top of my stack, right? Like, folks need to be thinking about their methods and playing with stuff. And you mentioned the genesis of the project and kind of how you're building the corpus. But if you would, if there's other stuff to say, I want to talk more about the methods for your project, because I imagine just like the technologies that you're studying, Anuj, the methods that you're using are emergent. So could you tell me a little bit more? Like, tell us a little bit more about your methodological approach, the methods. It could be larger stuff. It could be the nitty gritty. I'll let you take it away.
Yeah. I think I'm a methods nerd, so I'm happy to talk like all day about methods. I feel like that is one of the things that I really love teaching, methods classes and those kinds of things. One of the formative essays that really shaped my thinking about methods in rhetoric and composition is Richard Haswell's kind of controversial 2005 essay about NCT's war on scholarship, where he gives this idea about a certain kind of research, which he calls RAD research, R-A-D, by which he means replicable, aggregable, and data-driven, which at that time he felt like wasn't being given enough attention in RETCOM. And he makes an argument that this is what we need to change. And that really helped me kind of think about how there are these different traditions of research within RETCOM rather than a tradition. And all of them need to be in dialogue with each other instead of people just kind of caricaturizing the other side, which is sometimes, unfortunately, what you see. And I've been on both sides. So you often have like qualitative folks kind of demonizing anything to do with the quant side of things because it feels like that's too positivistic or that's too kind of, you know, it doesn't capture the complexity of the writing processes. Whereas on the quant side, you often see people caricaturizing the qualitative stuff like, hey, this is not generalizable. What's the point of this? It's just hocus pocus or everything that's going on. And I find my sweet spot in people who combine the two approaches in mixed methods research, take the best of both worlds and kind of, you know, build something on, along those lines. So that's the larger framework of methods that I'm interested in. And specifically for this dissertation, I'm really inspired by a recent book that came out in the VAC Clearinghouse by Carradini and Swartz, 2023. It's called Texts at Scale: Corpus Analysis in Technical Communication. It really introduces corpus methods for writing studies in a very accessible way. And I think it attunes these methods to the values that are practiced within writing studies. So for example, they talk about how just because you're building a corpus and analyzing it, that doesn't mean your research becomes positivistic or generalizable. You can still do a kind of qualitative research using corpus methods. Your positionality is still very important. Just because you're using a corpus, your research does not automatically become objective. Your embodied interpretations still matter. So that's really important for my work. And also a book that's very recently come out by John Gallagher. It's called Case Study Research in the Digital Age. I think he has a chapter in the two collections you showed, which I also really like, which really helps us see the kind of gives vocabulary to talk about the different elements in digital networks like users, interfaces, and his famous work on algorithmic audiences. kind of the whole infrastructure of bodies and materialities that go into creating anything, like just this conversation that you and I are having. He gives people a vocabulary about that. And he gives this notion that researchers should create iterative boundaries around what they're studying, because as you said, technologies are constantly evolving. Like, we might wake up tomorrow and be something new. So researchers need to be flexible to keep reworking the boundaries around what they're studying as the study proceeds. So that has been really helpful as a kind of epistemological heuristic for me. And along with this, I am using genre theory, which I've really benefited from. Specifically, I am using genre-specific knowledge, which is a kind of concept given by Chris Tardy, who is on my committee, another concept called rhetorical moves, which was originally kind of given by John Swales. And recently, people in RetComp like Ashley Rose, Mellon Barker, and S. Scott Graham have integrated it with a more rhetorical approach. Sorry, I'm just rambling at this stage. But to put it shortly and sweetly, I am collecting samples of a genre that I'm interested in called AI prompts, and I'm creating a corpus out of those samples. And once I have those samples, I will be doing mixed methods analysis using both qualitative and quantitative techniques.
You're not rambling. What you're doing is you're setting a foundation for other scholars in the future who might want to do this work, right? Yeah. They might hear this podcast episode and hear about this, you know, approach. So I don't think you're rambling. Plus, I was intrigued.
I'm glad you said that, because like one of the contributions I really want to make is to provide a new method, a new framework for scholars interested in doing research on digital writing technologies. And I think one of my contributions is that hey, if you're interested in studying a digital writing technology, focus on how it's changing genres of communication around you. Collect those samples and see what's going on in those genres. Like, really study the genre mutations almost that new technologies engender.
That's great, Anoush. Thanks for sharing that. So you've got so much to talk about in terms of publications, articles, upcoming things, but I'll be honest, I'm going to be selfish. I chose a couple of things to ask you about, if that's okay. So The first thing, and I think that the reason I wanted to ask you about this specific book that you wrote and that was published in 2022 is because it's an open access book. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a value of mine in terms of what I'm doing with this podcast, in terms of making scholarship accessible. And so I want to hear more about this book called Critical Language Awareness, Language Power Techniques and English Grammar, which is published through the University of Arizona Libraries. Tell us a little bit about what this book is and how you anticipate instructors could use it in the classroom.
Yeah, it's a project that's really close to my heart. This was a project started by one of my professors at the university, Professor Jonathan Reinhardt. And I had a bunch of kind of other colleagues, Robert Poole and Dilara, who's a classmate of mine. All of us were working on it together. And the whole idea kind of came from, Jonathan Reinhardt, he's from applied linguistics. And this book is kind of a merging of rhetoric theory and applied linguistics, because we felt that often you have rhetoric people are really good with unpacking rhetorical devices in a text. Like, hey, here is how propaganda is working. These are the kind of metaphors that are at play here. And here is how the ideology has been constructed. And what the applied linguists are really good at is they're very good at going deeper to analyze what are the language units or what are the grammatical linguistic devices that have been used to create those rhetorical devices. So this book kind of merges the two, the language and the rhetoric, and it gives teachers like really accessible ways in which to teach this to their students. So if you just look at the outline of the book, what you have is we have modules on rhetoric and we have modules on language and grammar. And then we talk about like how you can pair those in your classroom. So for example, if you want to teach the module on metaphor, and we take you through like how politicians use metaphors to create rhetoric. And then the chapter will kind of talk about, along with this, you can teach the grammar unit on nouns, on adjectives, which often go into creating metaphors. So you parallel the two elements together. And each chapter is very accessibly written with lots of fun videos and images. Incidentally, a friend of mine from India, Pravesh, he was also part of this project, and he created custom animated videos for each of the chapters illustrating the concepts. So it's got really cool videos. And Robert Poole and I kind of created some of the corpus exercises. So each chapter also accompanies some fun corpus exercises where you can access freely available corpora like COCA, which is the corpus of contemporary American English, and you can analyze some of the metaphors and some of the grammatical units in it. And the best part, as you said, is that it's open access. Professor John Reinhard had been given a very generous grant by a donor, which funded kind of my graduate assistantship and kind of others on the project to work on it with him. And that's why this book is available to offer free. Nobody needs to pay anything. And I really like that model of scholarship. I'm learning a lot from it.
Me too, really. I want to tease another project that you've got coming up. You got with Amber Buck, Rich Shivner, and David Code. Is that how you say David Simpson Code?
Yeah.
I thought it was. I'm actually, of all the four of you, he's the person I haven't met. And you all had a CFP come out last year, and you've collected your chapters. Full disclosure, I've got a co-author chapter in there with some friends. I got like half the field. Alas, tell us a little bit about that project, which is currently titled what is it called? Oh my gosh, I can't remember. Help me with it. I'm struggling with my notes and I'm in the thing.
Digital Literacies for Human Connection, an edited collection focusing on AI, VR, AR, and social media. So full disclosure, this is kind of David's brainchild. It's his vision. Okay. He came to us with this idea. And what he wanted us to do was kind of bring our expertise on the different technologies that we're doing research on to be section editors for that. So I'm the section editor for the AI section. Richard is handling the AR, VR, as well as other technology section. And Amber Buck is doing the social media section. And I think what really sets this book project apart is this focus on bringing the human connection when engaging with these technologies out, which I think has been so central to the whole field of computers and writing and techcom, to kind of talk about where is the human, where is the humanistic when we are engaging with these technologies and how we can kind of bring that out. So it's really fascinating for us to see how all contributors, including your submission and others, are trying to operationalize what a human connection is when you're working with technology, and so many cool ideas. So I think just like looking at the contents page of this collection is going to be really heartening for a lot of us. And all the activities are really practical in the sense of, I really like this model that David created. I think this is from one of the earlier books that he also published, where authors introduce a small concept that tells us about how human connection can be created with a certain technology. And then they have an activity about how to teach it in class. So it's going to be very practical, and it's going to really enrich people's theoretical understanding. So the proposal is currently under review. So fingers crossed, and let's see how it goes.
Yes. Okay. Excellent. I'm going to have to write down in my notes to reach out to David too. Maybe we can talk to the whole group when the book comes out.
That'll be amazing. Yeah.
So you turned us back to AI. And so I want to be forward thinking as we begin working towards the end of the interview. So what do you think, Anuj? What's going to be the future impact of generative AI on writing? Now, this is a huge question, right? 5 years, 10 years down the line, what do you think is going to be the future impact of generative AI on writing?
Ooh, I love crystal ball gazing kind of questions. And yeah, again, full disclaimer, these are just wild speculations. But something that I've thought about before, like a range of possibilities. One, I think, and other scholars have said this too, that what AI will do, at least generative AI, is that it might standardize human discourse a lot. In the sense of like most AI tools are trained on certain or on a majority of certain dialects of English, often certain kind of formal registers of American English or British English. And in their responses, they're going to regurgitate that dialect. And when people start using those outputs, integrating them with their writing, it's quite possible that discourse across the world becomes less heterogeneous, becomes a lot more homogeneous. However, I also feel that with more and more people, especially historically marginalized folks, getting access to these tools, I think that more people will have greater access to that standardized discourse. So it could potentially be like a mixed bag where you feel, I mean, I would feel bad that the richness of human discourse is reducing, but more people are able to access and use it to gain power. So that's kind of a plus. And another thing I feel like is that notions of authorship, copyright, plagiarism, all of these notions are going to change a lot. At least I think so. We right now kind of operate on this modern, almost romantic notion of this single author who owns a work, and there's a brooding author sitting in a kind of study table working on a book, and it's their property, they own it, they have all of that. I think lots of people have been pushing against that model to think about post-humanist conventions of authorship, and I think Gen AI might just be the tipping point which makes us rethink a lot of these notions. And something that I like to speculate about is before we had print cultures or writing heavy cultures, when a lot of communities were orality based, you often didn't have this notion of authorship and copyright, right? Discourse was collectively owned, and people could not say, hey, I own this page of thought and I will make money from it. But you have fables and myths that are collectively communally owned. I wonder if something like that might happen in the future. I don't know, just wild speculation. And another thing I feel is that we might start to see changes in how people reason in new generations, especially people who grew up with generative AI. Like all of us are people who did our schooling without Gen AI and we're using it now, but there's a new generation of kids who are already using it from grade one, grade two onwards. And the cynical view of that would be, hey, they won't have complex reasoning patterns because they won't write, they'll just use ChatGPT to generate answers. But I feel like with each new technology, you have those fears. And what people do is generate new forms of complexities, new reasonings, and new argumentation using that. Like people would say that initially they said that, hey, a podcast is not an academic argument. It's not scholarly enough, right? And thankfully, people like you are changing that notion. So I don't know, we might have new ways of making arguments using Gen AI, which allows new forms of reasonings to come in. So yeah, these are the kind of three or four speculations I have. But the most important one is that no matter what changes happen, humans will digest it. Like what you've seen over the last 2 years, that like we are amazing digesters of all chaos. Even now, like ChatGPT is not that old, but if he's like, yeah, sure, it's another technology, cool, let's see what we can do with it, it's not seeming like something that's going to break the world anymore, right? It already feels like it's kind of getting assimilated. So I think no matter what, we'll digest it, we'll assimilate it, and we'll figure out and keep moving on.
If you're smart listeners, you'll go back and listen to that response again with the news and his crystal ball, because you laid out so many different ideas for folks to build upon. There was probably 15 book projects in that response. that was beautiful. Thanks for sharing it. So as we digest the technology, as we move from generation to a generation, which is something I've been focusing on a bit recently in my scholarship, right? This idea of ambivalence to digital data privacy and surveillance. I want to think about pedagogy and AI and the things you're doing. How do you hope instructors take up some of our field's emerging ideas about teaching with AI and adapt it into their pedagogy?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question. I'm a big fan of heuristics and frameworks because they allow for easy adoption. And I feel like we are moving towards creating those frameworks or making them more accessible, especially for folks outside our fields. And I really like Mahabali's work. She's a scholar from Egypt who was one of the first people to write kind of an essay called, like, what do I mean when I say critical AI literacy? Even though she's kind of not technically within RETCOM, she's more in EdTech, but she is very close to a lot of RETCOM discourse as well. And I had the fortune to work with her on a recent paper. She's come out with a new blog that I want to kind of plug in through your podcast, where she has a framework that teachers can really use. Most of us are really familiar with Bloom's taxonomy, this list of 4 or 5 learning outcomes or language that we can use to create exercises, which involves starting with things like understanding and then moves on to applying and critiquing and evaluating and things like that. So I think her framework uses similar language, and it says that there are 5 kind of areas or dimensions within critical AI literacy. First is understanding how it works. Then is recognizing inequalities and biases in it. Then is examining ethical issues. Then crafting effective prompts and assessing appropriate uses. So I think it's a mixture of kind of what Stuart Selber in his multiliteracies framework calls like functional digital literacies, critical digital literacies, and rhetorical digital literacies. So I think what teachers can really take from a lot of this work happening is that if you want to teach about these technologies, figure out how to teach them functionally, how students can use it, understand the very basics of them, and complement that with more critical ways of understanding and critiquing the technology, and then teach them how to merge the functional and the critical with more rhetorical perspective so that students can take action with that technology in an informed manner. And my dissertation will add a small but hopefully significant contribution in this larger landscape by providing teachers with better ways to teach prompts as a genre. Genre is vocabulary that many writing teachers are already familiar with. So if we introduce ChatGPT prompts as a genre, it'll be easier for uptake inside our classrooms. And my work will kind of help them with a descriptive snapshot of what are the different rhetorical moves, what different things are people doing with prompts, how can students learn to flexibly experiment with them. And it'll also give them a sense of what are the range of uses that people are putting generative AI to so that they can create their own acceptable AI use policies.
That's awesome. I'm going to have to look that heuristic up. And I love how you're bringing some Selber in here too. So a couple of more questions, really just one more substantial one, and then we'll kind of put the wheels down. Mm-hmm. So grad school is so hard. It's so challenging. It's for many of us, some of us know, but for most of us, it's one of the most challenging parts of our lives. So what are some of the things that you do to navigate the difficulties of graduate school? What are some of the things you're grateful
for? Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this. I think I'm really, really grateful for my parents who live in India. This is the first time I'm staying apart from them, so I miss them really every day. And as I grow older, I'm starting to come out of my teenage rebellion phase where I used to hate them, and I'm starting to love, respect, and appreciate them a lot more, especially when I stay away from them now. And my family, my sisters, and everyone. Also kind of my wife, who is also a grad student. She goes to Michigan State. She lives in East Lansing. So I think I'm really fortunate that I'm with a partner who's at a similar stage in their PhD journey, and both of us are going on this journey together so we can really support each other. I've also been really fortunate to have a range of friends and mentors in the US as an international student, it can get very lonely and very difficult to navigate a whole set of challenges. But my PhD advisor, Professor Susan Miller Cochran, lots of my friends, Charlie, Dwight, Darsh, Cheryl, and many others kind of have really been helping me out through a whole range of crises that I've gone through over the last 3-4 years. And I also practice a form of Buddhism called Nichiren Buddhism, which has a really vibrant community here in the US. So that also really gives me a lot of strength, spirituality, and kind of resilience to deal with all kinds of chaos. And yeah, I'm generally just grateful for everything in my life, each breath, each vibration that I get to experience. And I hope that each breath I take also helps me increase happiness in the universe.
What's next for you, Anuj? This could be a question where you explain your future research and teaching plans, or just you can share where folks can find information about you and your research online.
Yeah. To find me online, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is an embarrassing kind of stage name I have from high school. I used to play guitars then, and my stage name used to be Metal Rose. I was a big, still I'm a big Guns N' Roses fan, inspired from Axl Rose. So I used to call myself Metal Rose with a double T. So you can find me on Twitter at @MetTalrose. And in less embarrassing ways of contacting me, you can email me at anujgupta@arizona.edu. I don't have a website yet, which is something I should build now that I'll be going on the job market soon. And yes, in terms of what's next for me, I'm currently working on my dissertation. I submit it next year. I defend in, I believe, May 25. So next year. And after that is when I'll be going on the job market and trying to see where I can continue my research and teaching next.
Congratulations, Anuj, on so many of your wonderful projects, on your dissertation, and good luck on the job market next year. Thanks for this interview.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Charles. I had so much fun, and thank you so much for this beautiful service that you do for the whole field.
Well, there you have it, folks. Our first episode of season 10. Can you believe it? And an emerging scholar episode. I'm so glad Anuj and I are finally able to coordinate this interview. Reach out to me. Reach out to Anuj. I'll be back next week with another new episode. A surprise on TBR. Until then, always be listening rhetorically.
The Big Rhetorical Podcast is produced by Exalt Digital Media. Exalt Digital Media, not for profit. The Big Rhetorical Podcast was recorded on the land of many Native nations, past and present. These original homelands are territories of indigenous peoples who are largely dispossessed and removed. We specifically acknowledge the traditional stewardship of this land by the Wichita, Kickapoo, and Tawakoni peoples. Music for the Big Rhetorical Podcast is brought to you by DJ Lang, Steffa Helix, and Ketza.